Welcome to Sci-Fi On Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And today's episode is going to be the first of a three-part series tackling Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy. For today, we're going to be talking about his 2005 film, Batman Begins. So a little bit of background about Batman Begins. The beginning of this film's development came at the end of sort of the Joel Schumacher Batmans. I guess the last Schumacher Batman was Batman and Robin. And in 1996, while Schumacher was filming Batman and Robin, I guess Batman Forever, the previous film, had done really well. So while he was filming Batman and Robin, Warner, wanting a third Schumacher Batman film, hired a guy named Mark Protasevich to write something continual. And he wrote something called Batman Triumphant. And so that was kind of in the wings to be done. But Batman and Robin did terrible at the box office, thank God, and critically. And so Warner Brothers changed tack, and they decided to go forward in sort of two ways. They were thinking about a live-action Batman Beyond film, which, if those of you who don't know, Batman Beyond was an animated Batman series. I think they did three seasons of it. And it's basically set in the near future. Bruce Wayne is an old, sort of an aging man who's alone in his Wayne Manor. No one talks to him. And this young man, I forget his name, Joel something, stumbles into Wayne Manor and convinces Wayne, you know, to allow him to carry on the mantle of the Bat. And actually, the first season of the animated series is very good. The plot's great because, you know, Wayne is basically the little bird whispering in his ear as he's going out and doing missions. And so very interesting if they would have gone that direction. So they had that as one track. And then they were thinking about bringing Frank Miller's Batman Year One to the screen, which is a terrific graphic novel. It came after his Batman Dark Knight Returns, which kind of changed comics forever, and especially Batman. And Miller's Year One was exactly that, basically tracing Batman's the creation of this persona and his first missions and so on and so forth, and very gritty, you know, just wonderful vintage Miller. Those two things in the fire. In September of 2000, a script for Batman Beyond was being ready, written by, I guess, three writers they name, Paul Dini, who's a comic book writer, Neal Stephenson, the novelist, and Boaz Yakin, who I don't know anything about. So there was a script for that. And then Warner Brothers also approached Darren Aronofsky to do the Year One adaptation with Frank Miller. They were going to do it together. So soon after that, I think Aronofsky sort of accepted, and they dropped the Batman Beyond approach and just focused on Year One. As that was sort of gaining in pre-production, that production approached Christian Bale for the role. And then, for whatever reason, by 2002, Warner Brothers decided not to go ahead with that, and they were going to go for Batman versus Superman. So they dropped Year One completely. Aronofsky went off to do other things, and that was that. So in January 2003, Batman versus Superman is dead. Warner Brothers hires Nolan to direct the reboot, and they hire David S. Goyer to write the script. They get Christian Bale. I believe he was approached and auditioned for the role, but he landed it, and they were set to go. So Christopher Nolan, prior to this film, had directed a no-budget thriller written by his brother Jonah called Following. Then after that, of course, Memento, which put him on the map. And then he did a fairly large-budget Hollywood thriller called Insomnia, which was a remake of, I believe, a Swedish film with Al Pacino and Robin Williams. And so after that, I guess he had made enough money on that film that he rated a shot at, you know, Warner Brothers' Batman franchise. Christian Bale was a child actor. He was in an amazing run of films as a kid. He was in Spielberg's Empire of the Sun. He was in Branagh's Henry V as Falstaff's boy. He was in Newsies, Swing Kids. And then as an adult, American Psycho kind of brought him out as a star in his own right. And then he was in some really cool speculative fiction movies, Reign of Fire, which is sort of post-apocalyptic dragons, which I like and I'll probably cover in a future podcast, a sci-fi film called Equilibrium, and then in a movie called The Machinist, directed by a guy named Brad Anderson. The score for this film was originally going to just be written by Hans Zimmer, but Zimmer asked Nolan if he could bring on James Newton Howard to co-compose. So it was kind of a different thing. You know, soundtrack composers are notoriously protective of their credits. Zimmer and Howard had always wanted to record together, and they combined their forces for this movie. It's a very influential score. It's been much imitated in pop movie making since. One of my favorite scores in recent memory. It really is an integral part of the film, very much like John Williams' scores for Star Wars. To the film. Just a brief note about how this film opens. The opening 42 minutes of this film is all set up, right? What they do is there are two timelines going simultaneously, and they flip back and forth. I'll call one childhood and one training, all right, just as we go back and forth. So, you know, and we cut back and forth from Bruce Wayne as a child and his adult training at the hands of Ra's al Ghul. And the story stays split like this until the Ra's al Ghul, first part of the Ra's al Ghul story ends and Wayne returns to Gotham. And then the narrative kind of comes together into one seamless timeline. And it's a pretty astounding way to begin a brand new franchise and open up a film, as I will definitely get more into as we go. So let's get started. The film opens up with this wonderful Hans Zimmer soundtrack swell. And we see this brooding sky, and there are like thousands and thousands of bats. They're flying past us, and they briefly form the bat signal. And then it kind of dissolves, and we're into the film. We cut to Bruce Wayne chasing young Rachel Dawes through the Wayne Manor Gardens. And there's this charging violins movie cue, which is, you know, Zimmer will use throughout this film. So they're playing a game called Finders Keepers with an old stone arrowhead. Rachel found it. She's hiding. And then Bruce finds her, takes the arrowhead from her and runs. And then he hides on top of an old stone well, which gives way. And we see him at the bottom of the well looking at this really creepy-looking opening. He hears something, and it's dark. And all of a sudden, you know, he's momentarily surrounded by bats that emerge out of this hole. So then we cut to our first shot of what I call the training sequence, and we're in a Chinese prison. You know, you could have asked me a thousand ways that a Batman movie was going to open. If you had said Chinese prison, I would have said you're crazy. It's a gritty, realistic kind of prison. It's kind of gross. We see guards toting guns, and Bruce Wayne is there. And we get the sense that he's being systematically targeted by these inmates that are there who are constantly coming at him. And so this particular morning, waiting online for breakfast, some guy comes up to him and punches him in the face. But right away, we see that Wayne is unfazed. And, you know, he says the line is, "Your practice." Takes the guy down, and then he begins to fight with about six or seven other guys. And we have our first fight in the film, which is sort of in this muddy area in the middle of the courtyard of the prison. The fight's not shot very well. A lot of the fights in this, for my taste, that Nolan goes more for effect than accuracy. We can tell that Bruce is really kicking ass and he's taking guys apart, and we see a leg there and an arm here. But there's really, it's happening so fast and he's cutting in and out so quickly that we really can't tell what's going on. Except the fact that he's winning, that he's beating all these men without much of a problem. And so the guards drag him away to solitary, and he kind of sort of, some nice moment of humor where he says, "I don't need protection," and the guards are like, "It's protection for them." And the camera cuts to the, you know, all the guys he's been fighting. They're all laying in the mud, groaning, defeated. This is an amazing way, again, to begin a Batman film. Just mud, grittiness, and griminess. As I've said in earlier podcasts, I think, and I'm such a fan of this, that if you go out of your way to ground whatever speculative story that's going to eventually get very, very speculative, like eventually, you know, Nolan's going to ask the audience to suspend their disbelief in quite a lot of ways. But for now, he's setting you in this world in a very dark and gritty way. So when he asks you later to take leaps with him, you do, you know, and I always think this is a terrific approach to doing anything fantastical, is to get your audience in the world. And maybe, you know, it doesn't necessarily, everything has to be gritty, but there needs to be a way for the audience to get into the world where you're in and it seems like a real functioning place that's, you know, that's not shiny and plastic. And I think it's done very well here. In solitary, there's a man waiting for him who names himself Ducard, played by the ever awesome Liam Neeson. One little nitpick in the scene, you know, how the hell does Ducard know that Wayne's going to get thrown into solitary? Unless Wayne gets thrown into solitary every day, it's a little nit, but this film to me rises above these little things eventually. So the big reveal here is that Ducard knows his name. You know, he knows he's a Wayne. And he, you know, kind of gives him the sense that you've lost your way here. If you there was something you were looking to do in your life, you know, you're lost. And he explains about this League of Shadows. A guy named Ra's al Ghul is the head of it. And Wayne scoffs. I guess he's heard of this group and he scoffs at them as like vigilantes. And then Ducard has this great line, and I'll quote, "A vigilante is just a man lost in the scramble for his own gratification. He can be destroyed or locked up. But if you make yourself more than just a man, if you devote yourself to an ideal, and if they can't stop you, then you become something else entirely." And Wayne asks, which is? And Ducard replies, "Legend, Mr. Wayne." Basically, he leaves with a little telltale. He tells him, if you can pick a blue flower that grows on the slopes of the mountains and carry it to the top, you may find the answers that you seek. So it turns out that he's about to be released from prison the next day. So we see him released. He is now decides to pick one of these flowers and follow up on Ducard's offer. And we get some beautiful exterior shots. Somehow, Nolan had found a real glacier. We see Bruce walking up towards it, and Zimmer's soundtrack swells up, and we really get a sense that this is a real place and how small Wayne is in the middle of it. And there's one really beautiful shot that I like. He's approaching the glacier, and he's ascending a hill. The camera's coming up with him over the hill. We crest this valley filled with these pennants flapping in the wind on these staffs, these wooden staffs. And just the way the camera rises to reveal it, and the pennants, and the score, just is very majestic, you know, very majestic. One of the examples, I think, of how this film rises above, at times, what can be a very didactic screenplay and set of thematic constraints. Somehow, Nolan, to me, very much achieves pop grandeur in many scenes, and I will narrate them all. He gets finally to the top of the, you know, the glacier, top of the mountain. There's this beautiful compound, which we get a nice little look of, this sort of Asian, Tibetan-ish compound built right into the mountaintop. And Wayne pounds on the door, and he enters, and there's a nice bit of suspense. There's no one around, and he's exhausted. And then we see who we come to believe at this point in the story, Ra's al Ghul, played by Ken Watanabe, sitting on a throne of some kind, speaking in Chinese. And all of a sudden, these other assassins appear out of nowhere, and they surround him. But Ducard jumps out, and he tells them to wait, and he asks Bruce what he seeks. And Wayne has a carefully composed answer. And he says, "I seek the means to fight injustice, to turn fear against those who prey on the fearful." So Ducard replies, "To manipulate the fears of others, you must master your own. Are you ready to begin?" And Wayne's like, "I'm exhausted." And Ducard comes at him and they spar briefly. But Wayne is no match for Ducard. He's exhausted. What's nice here is that we're getting a little aside to Ducard says something like, "This is not a dance." So we're getting a sense that they want to approach the martial arts fights in this movie as not dance-like and balletic, as has come to be the standard in a lot of action movies. Because at the end of their brief sparring, Ducard headbutts him and knocks him down. And the sequence ends with this great line, "You are afraid, but not of me. Tell us, Mr. Wayne, what do you fear?" And then we cut back. Now we're back in childhood. And there's this wonderful shot. Wayne is still at the bottom of the well, and there's a low-angle shot right up the well, and his father, played by Linus Roach, is sort of coming down, rappelling on a rope to get Bruce, who's been severely, severely traumatized. As he's being carried up the stairs of this, and the beautiful, wherever they found this manor where they film Wayne Manor, I mean, it is beautiful. Beautiful house, you know, beautiful grounds, and you really immediately are like, wow, you know, Wayne's like, the Wayne family is exceedingly rich. They live in this amazing place. So Wayne Manor is nailed. So as he's being carried up the stairs by his dad, we come to understand that his leg has been broken. His father is a doctor by way of him saying, "I'll set the bone and go, you know, take him to the hospital later for an x-ray." And we also meet Alfred, played by Michael Caine. And as Bruce's father is walking him past Rachel and the housekeeper, who I'm not sure if it's Rachel's mother or not, but I think so. I think maybe she grew up on Wayne Manor. He hands the arrowhead back to Rachel, and that's a key plot point to come later. So then there's a pretty corny line as Thomas Wayne is instructing his son, "Why do we fall, Bruce? So we can learn to pick ourselves back up again." And there's a bunch of clunkers like that in this film. You know, that strangely work because of their good intention and naivete, right? If I was in a room full of hip people, I don't think I could say that. I think I'd have to like, yeah, it's a clunky line. Something in me responds to the earnestness behind it, and but at the same time recognizing the lack of art that's used in its delivery. Let's put it that way. And this theme of picking ourselves back up again is brought up again in the film, as all the themes in this film are continually brought through. It's pretty terrific in that way. So next, we see Bruce. He wakes up one morning. He's having a nightmare. His father is there. We realize he's dreaming about bats a lot. And he's explaining to Bruce that the bats attacked him because they were afraid of him. And his son is curious, do all creatures feel fear, especially the scary ones? And his father sort of says yes, you know, and he's planting. Again, this theme of fear is a huge one. I mean, this whole film is basically about fear in one way or the other. And it's everywhere, which is really, I think, is really cool. The film just soaks it up from every bloody angle it can. I don't know. Again, it's another one of the things that thematically it's so unified that it transcends its trappings. Comic fans briefly here will recognize that Bruce's father is showing him these pearls that he's going to give his mom that night because they're going out. And we know right away what those pearls mean because they've been in most of the Death of Bruce Wayne's parents' scenes over the years, especially the Frank Miller Dark Knight one. Now they're en route to the event they're going to that night, and they're on the train, and we're introduced to the Gotham Transit System, which is going to come into play near again later in the film. The character of Thomas Wayne, you know, we're not allowed for the Waynes to just be rich. They have to, like, devote their lives to the poor. So Wayne is like, you know, we built this train system as a treat public transportation system because the city's been good to us, and he doesn't work at Wayne Enterprises. He works at the hospital. So, like, come on, dude, you know, like, all right. So they kind of gild a little bit with the Wayne. They're like the most amazing family anyone has ever been. You know, they're these incredible do-gooders. And it is what it is. So take it as you like it. Now, the next shot we see the Waynes are at an opera. I looked it up because I wasn't sure what this was. It was called Mephistopheles by a composer named Arito Boito, based, of course, on the Faust legend. And this is a departure from the comic book canon because the canon really has Bruce going to see Zorro, which is kind of, you know, part of how he creates, you know, the idea to create the character of that he will play Batman comes from, you know, seeing the film Zorro and having it be impressed upon him. I think I agree with their choice not to do Zorro, I mean, not to bring in another, you know, intellectual property, as it were. It's sort of a Faust opera. In the audience, they're watching it, the family, and there's a scene where some of the opera non-singing roles are dressed up as bats, and they're actually on these cool ropes, and they're coming down from the ceiling. And young Bruce kind of freaks out. He asks his father if he can go, and his father, you know, recognizes that he's scared, and because he's a perfect father, he, you know, they leave the opera. And now we have this classic scene in Crime Alley where they're all accosted by this sort of drifter named Joe Chill. Bruce's father is all calm and relaxed. He gives him his wallet. He's like, it's fine. Just take the wallet and go. He wants the pearls, and there's some motion that Thomas makes to protect his wife, and Chill thinks he's being attacked, so he shoots Thomas Wayne and then shoots the wife. Takes the pearls, takes the money, and runs off. And then there's this beautiful elegiac soundtrack cue that comes up with this young boy singing in the background, and the camera tracks low away from Bruce, and he's kneeling amidst his parents. His father looks at him, and his last words are, don't be afraid. And it's a beautiful shot. So the next scene, we see young Bruce still in his tux, sitting in the police station, and he's being comforted by a young Jim Gordon, played by Gary Oldman. Oldman doesn't know what the hell to say to this kid. His parents have just been murdered. So he winds up just putting a coat around his shoulder. He looks at him, and he just keeps saying, it's okay, it's okay. And the look on Oldman's face is amazing. What Oldman puts into this look is so beautiful because he's humbled by the boy's pain, and he doesn't go into any kind of bullshit line. Like, he doesn't go into any kind of crap. He just keeps saying that it's okay, you're going to be okay, knowing that anything else to be said is absurd. Future Commissioner Loeb, I don't know what his rank is in this timeline here, but he walks in, and he's like, good news, son, you know, we got him. But of course, it's all hollow, you know, and it doesn't, whether they have him or not is kind of irrelevant at this point. And then we cut to the funeral on the Wayne estate. Again, there's another elegiac scene, the beautiful Hans Zimmer score, that wonderful vocal melody that we hear when the parents got killed. We hear it again. And there's this great shot. It's raining out, and the camera tracks sort of left in front of the manor. And the sea of black umbrellas sort of emerges from left as well. And it's beautiful, beautiful scene. Very poetic, very striking, really kind of amazing, actually. And again, you know, balancing some of the didactic elements of the film. Then Rutger Hauer enters, plays a character by the name of Earl. And he tells Bruce that we'll be watching the Empire. When you grow up, you can take it over. And then another beautiful shot from outside. We're looking up at Wayne Manor, and we see little Bruce by himself framed in a window. Then from his point of view, we're looking down, and we see little Rachel, and she looks up at him, and she waves, and he waves, but her mother kind of whisks her away. You know, and he's kind of cut off now, isolated and insulated in this world of money and privilege after, you know, having this incredible tragedy happen to him, and it's beautifully done. And then one of my favorite scenes in the film, Alfred enters the room. He says, I thought I might prepare a little supper. And Bruce turns around, and the kid playing Bruce Wayne is amazing. He starts to cry, and he said, Alfred, it's all my fault if I hadn't gotten scared. And Alfred comes to him very quickly. He's like, no, 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 the fault is his and his alone, nothing that you did. And Kane is amazing because he's such a master actor. We see in this like 4-second shot of his face how earnest he is and how much he needs Bruce to believe that you are not taking this on. You know, you are not going to grow up taking on this guilt. And it's a beautiful heartbreaker of a moment. And then the killer, which I always, the tears always with me on this one, as Bruce says, I miss them, Alfred. I missed him so much. And he starts crying and he hugs Alfred. And then the camera zooms in on Alfred and Alfred says, so do I. And I mean, it's so beautifully handled. It's so respectful and beautiful. And there's no sop to One Day Son or any of this crap. It just allows the pain of this moment to play out with classy actors, really good acting, and really respectful scenes. Like it's, I was so impressed with how they handled the death of his parents scene. It really, again, the film really stands up on adult legs. So far, what have you seen? You've seen a gritty Chinese prison scene. You've seen Bruce sort of in a monastery in China. And then you've seen this poor boy's tragedy. Like it's, we are in this film, man. We are in this film 100%. So now we cut back to Roz's stronghold and we're back in the training sequence. So Bruce is now an adult. And Roz is like asking Bruce about these memories. And we get the sense that Bruce is like, my anger outweighs my guilt. They start having this duel with swords out on this glacier. Roz is teaching Bruce sort of sword play. And they're using these metal gauntlets with these sort of curved spikes. What's great about this movie is that every single part of his costume is dealt with directly. There's a purpose to it. And it makes sense. And besides how well they handle the story, this technical and very, very realistic way that they deal with every part of his costume, to me, is so impressive. I think it's glossed over. You know, I know everyone goes gaga over The Dark Knight. And yes, it's a great film. This film is deceptive. I think it's still my favorite of the three because it's deceptively brilliant on just exactly how they create this character from nothing. They're dueling on the ice, and then they're also cutting back and forth with Roz's training lectures. So there are other scenes back in the stronghold, ninjas dropping down silently from the ceiling, and we see that, you know, they're using these special grips and spikes that they hold in their hands. We see Bruce kind of on this area of just where he's on a pylon and he has to stay balanced, and they're pummeling him with these staffs. Then while they're on the ice, we get the always mind your surroundings, obviously, you know, on looking for thin ice out on the glacier. And that's going to be echoed later in the film a couple of times. And we get a line, Roz teaches him about ninjas, you know, employing explosive powders. And we get this line, theatricality and deception are powerful agents, which is a line that, again, will reappear later in the film. And we're also introduced briefly to a man in a cage who's been captured by the League of Shadows. And Roz explains that he tried to take his neighbor's land and he killed him. And now he's a prisoner. Bruce says, what's going to happen to him? Justice. Crime cannot be tolerated. Criminals thrive on society's understanding. So we're hinting at this kind of sinister nature of the League, but nothing too overt right now. So psychologically, Roz basically wants to burn away Bruce's anger so he can confront the guilt over his parents' death and deal with it directly and freeing him from it. So as they're dueling on the ice, he gets up close and he says, your parents' death was not your fault, it was your father's. And Bruce flips out and he starts coming at him. But of course, Roz is his superior at this point, fends him off. The whole debate between the two is that, you know, Bruce is like, the man had a gun. And Roz is like, would that have stopped you? And Bruce is saying, no, I've had training. The lesson he's trying to impart is that training is nothing, that the will is everything. The will to act is the most important thing. So they duel, and now somehow Bruce gets Roz at his mercy. Roz is down. Bruce has him. And he gets him to heels, and Roz says, you know, you've sacrificed sure footing for a killing stroke. And he basically taps the ice underneath Bruce, and he falls into it. And then we get this brief scene around a campfire that, you know, he's warning Bruce that, you know, this anger undealt with will eventually kill you, as it once did me. And we find out that Ra's has lost a great love, which is amazingly dealt with in Dark Knight Rising. Like, this trilogy is so intertwined with one another. It's pretty incredible. But he tells Bruce, is like, well, what saved you? He's like, vengeance. And it's a great lead-in to Bruce, like, that's no help to me. And Ra's is like, why, Bruce? Why did you not avenge your parents' death? So now we're cutting back to Bruce's childhood, except instead of childhood now, this is youth. And we see a youthful Bruce Wayne in his late teens, early 20s, home from college. And the Wayne Mansion at this point is sort of a mausoleum. All the furniture is draped by cloths. It looks like Wayne doesn't, you know, he's always away from home. Alfred probably lives in the servants' quarters. We get a sense of how angry and disconnected he is from this whole thing. And that, you know, Alfred has prepared the master bedroom. And Wayne says, no, my own room is fine. And then if I had my way, I would burn this whole place down. So the memory of it is so painful to him. He wants it all to go away. And he's a very angry, wastrel kind of young man, directionless and kind of lost. Alfred is basically, you know, what's left of the parental relationships in his life. And he's always like, I have faith in you. I'll never give up on you, which is another, you know, corny piece of this film. But there's an earnestness in it, again, that strangely works, I think, even though it's delivered in kind of a, you know, never give up on you. And there's a wonderful moment that where Bruce is in the house. Alfred has left him alone and he picks up his father's stethoscope case. And we get a mini flashback of him as a child listening to his dad's heartbeat, which I think really is the metaphor. You know, this happens a couple of times, and I think the flashback of his father's heartbeat is kind of the metaphor of the Wayne family line and what that means to him, and in a sense, the heart beating in his, you know, in his fate in his life. And again, it's a beautiful little scene, and it's these kind of scenes that are peppered in this movie, which elevates it above the genre. It's a beautiful scene, just, you know, a father and a son, wordless for a moment, you know, and you're just like, I'm always amazed. Briefly, while we see him unpacking, we see that he has a pistol. And now, basically, he's home for the hearing of Joe Chill, who 15, 17 years later is finally getting out of prison. He comes downstairs, and his old pal Rachel Dawes is going to drive him to the hearing. And as an adult, she's played by Katie Holmes. And a little aside about the role of Rachel Dawes, I don't love Katie Holmes in this role. She does what she can. What's great about this role is that she's not in this film to just be a love interest, like so many women's roles in superhero movies. They're just around to, like, be the conscience of the hero and to love them, you know. And, you know, she is his conscience in this, but throughout the whole movie, she has her own storyline. She exists independently of Bruce. And yes, their stories come together, and some of what she does kind of instigates some of his actions and vice versa, but she has a through line in this film. She is her own person, her own story, and quite a powerful character. And I think it's impressive. I think she's not this same character in Dark Knight, especially played by Maggie Gyllenhaal. I think at that point, she's caught between two men, and her purpose is basically to be caught between two men. She has very little to do in that movie except, you know, die. Props to Rachel Dawes as written in this film. I think she's a very unique character that I don't know that, you know, it's noticed a lot when people talk about this movie. Now we hear a little bit of the plot, you know, that she, what I like about this too is that not only is she her own person, her and her boss, she's the assistant DA, and her boss Finch is the DA of Gotham. Chill plea bargained into parole. He served 17 years for the murder. He shared a cell with a guy named Carmine Falcone, who seems to be the head of organized crime in Gotham. He's going to testify against Falcone. In exchange, they're going to let him out into parole. So Rachel basically is like, look, man, you know, I know your parents got killed and it sucks, but he served time. This other guy is really the guy who's really nailing, taking the city down. And, you know, we have to kind of get outside of our own pain. But right now, Bruce is like, I cannot let that pass. May I kill my parents, Rachel? He doesn't give a shit about anything else except revenge at this point. But it's a great setup. And then we cut to the courtroom and we see Finch, the DA, talking about, you know, time served and so on and so forth. And then Chill gets up. The judge asks him if he has anything to say. And it's a great moment where Chill says, yeah, I was starving, but that doesn't excuse what I did. And he's fully penitent about, you know, killing Bruce's parents. Like he understands and kind of takes responsibility for it. Bruce is livid. I mean, now seeing this man for the first time in all these years, There's a great scene. There's a great moment when the judge says, "Is there a member of the Wayne family, and does he have anything to say?" And Bruce stands up, and he just turns around and walks out. He's just completely full of rage. So he's in the parking lot, and he's getting the gun ready. Chill comes out the side, getting ready to kill him. And then this woman, who Falcone had hired to take him out, kills him, like pulls a Jack Ruby on him, walks up to him, pulls the gun out, and shoots him dead. Then he's in the car later with Rachel, and Rachel realized that Falcone paid off the judge to get Chill out in the open so he could get the hitman in to kill him. And I like that it's a woman hitman, just for something different. You know, it's kind of cool. And now they have this argument, which is formative to Bruce's character and Batman's as well, in that Bruce is, maybe I should thank Falcone. And Rachel's like, you want to thank him? And she explains the bigger picture of what's going on in Gotham. The Falcone's flooding the city with drugs. And there's all kinds of crime. And that, you know, he may not have killed your parents, but he's creating new Joe Chills every day. And, like, he's really, in a sense, not so much Chill, but this guy who's kind of behind the evil in Gotham that, you know, caused your parents to die. And he doesn't give a shit. He's like, he shows her the gun. He's like, I'm not one of your good people, Rachel. And she slaps him a couple of times. It's like, your parents would be ashamed of you. And if you want to thank Falcone, here he is. And she's down, you know, in some kind of seedy part of town. And so he gets out of the car. And in that moment, he kind of realizes that she was right, and he freaks out. We see a flashback of Chill shooting his parents. And all of a sudden, he launches the gun out into the harbor. We're setting up Batman's character. You know, why does Batman not use a gun, right? It's part of his comic book character. Batman did use a gun way back in the day. Like, if you go back in the 30s and 40s, you know, if you see early Batman comics, he did use a gun. You know, since the sort of Silver Age, Batman really is gunless. And it's now really an accepted part of his character that he uses gadgets and brute strength and cunning and darkness and everything else, but not a gun. And so I like that the writers address that. Not just that a gun is bad, but that it's personal to him. Like, a gun is the thing that took away his life, you know, took away his family, and that he would never resort to using one again, which is great. You know, Rachel here is the keeper of his conscience and serves that purpose well. So now Wayne walks into the bar and has a scene with Carmine Falcone, played by the great Tom Wilkinson. And it's an important scene because, you know, what Rachel taught him sort of in that moment about revenge and about guilt and about, you know, justice, Falcone is going to teach him some things as well before he sort of sets off on his road to becoming Batman. And he sits down with Falcone after the, you know, Falcone's thugs kind of look him over and, no gun, I'm insulted, you know. So Bruce thinks he's a big man. He tells him, you know, I want to let you know that not everyone in Gotham's afraid of you. And Falcone laughs at him. He's like, people from your world have so much to lose. And he shows Bruce how vulnerable he is, his butler, Rachel, and that he's so incredibly vulnerable. And again, it plants the seed where later when he decides to kind of get into the crime-fighting business, he realizes that he has to adopt some kind of persona to protect the people that he loves. And this is where it stems from. And then the second thing that Falcone teaches him is that, you know, you think that your mommy and daddy got shot. You know about the dark side of life, but you don't. You know, you don't know about crime. You don't know about real pain and real suffering. You're the Prince of Gotham. You'd have to go 1,000 miles to find someone who doesn't know your name. And he kind of chides him, like, don't come down here with all this anger. This is a world you'll never understand, you know, in accordance with the theme of the film. You know, you'll always fear what you don't understand. So Falcone's thugs throw him outside. And in that moment, Bruce decides, you know, he's been taught quite a valuable lesson. He exchanges his coat with a guy named Raed Sherbezdia. I always mess up his name, but he's a great character actor. I don't know if he's Serbian or Eastern European of some kind, but he has this moment where they trade coats, and he takes Raed's, you know, the homeless guy's coat, and then he runs to the dock, and we see him, you know, running towards a ship where he will eventually probably stow away. We have this montage, and we hear Roz and a narrator narrating over it. Did you learn about desperation and fear? And we see him crouching in like a marketplace and stealing fruit and sharing it with another, you know, poor kid. And we see the graying of his sort of moral philosophy that, you know, he realizes that there's so much gray area in terms of theft and crime, and learned a little bit about, you know, what it's like to go hungry. The first time, you know, he says the first time that I stole so I wouldn't starve, it really opened his eyes to kind of the way the world works. And then we kind of flash forward a little bit to him committing the crime that got him locked up in the prison. He's with a bunch of criminals in a car, and they break into this warehouse to steal some goods. The Chinese police kind of gotten the wind of him, and they arrest him. And we see the goods he's trying to steal are boxes from Wayne Enterprises, which I think is very clever. we cut back to Ra's al Ghul's compound, and at this point forward, now we're on a singular narrative, like we've ended the two narratives. So now Bruce, basically, we're getting the sense that he's gone through a certain amount of training and that he's kind of about to graduate. This blue flower that he carried up will now be crushed down, and it's a hallucinogen. So we see him now, he's wearing armor, this leather ninja armor. He's like fully warred up, as it were. You know, he's been there a while. You can tell he's a little seasoned. And so this last test is that he needs to learn how to face his fears. He needs to journey inward, face the thing he's afraid of the most. And we get these great lines from Ra's that, you know, you need to feel fear, under, you know, you need to feel its power to distort. Now there's, you know, and not let fear affect his judgment and action. You know, watching this, I watch the scene over and over again, and I like it because, I mean, it's life, right? I mean, what do we go through every day? There are things in our life that frighten us, that make us afraid. And, you know, the best we do is when we can allow that fear to exist someplace inside us, you know, not turn away from it and try to distract ourselves from it with drink or drugs, or but to feel it and to have it there and just put it aside and say, I'm going to take the next actions, fear be damned, you know, to allow it to exist. And that's, I think that's the message of this sequence, that it's not like he's going to eradicate fear from his life, but he's going to learn to live inside of it and accept it as a real thing in life. It's this kind of a strange thing that he does, because now he's in a room full of masked warriors, all armed. He's high on this, Raish kind of crushes this thing and burns it, so he's inhaling the fumes and he's on this hallucinogen now. Ra's is hiding in the room. I guess the idea is to find him. It's dark and, you know, his fears are getting the best of him, you know. So we see for the first time how Nolan's going to deal with hallucinogenic fears that Bruce Wayne has, and he shows us. We see these bats flying around and there's other visual effects that are used to get a sense that he's not all there at this moment. Basically, Ra's is hiding in these ninjas, and then at one point, they all step away, and he and Ra's duel, and he never knows where Ra's is going to come from. They duel for a while, and then Ra's steps back into these ninjas, and he doesn't know where the hell he is, because they all look alike. So at one point, they move out of the way, and they allow him to approach this box, and he opens the box, and the box is really a metaphor for Bruce's deepest fears. And so in that moment, when he opens the box, bats fly out, and he kind of collapses down, because he's reacting to it. But you see that he slowly masters himself and he breathes and he gets up. When he's dueling with Ra's, he gets cut on the arm. Ra's disappears back into the ninjas. And then he cuts the arms of several of the other ninjas and then waits. And then at one point, Ra's thinks that it's Bruce. And he comes up behind one of the ninjas. He pulls off his helmet hat and he says, "You cannot leave any sign." And then we see Bruce behind him pull off his helmet and say, "I haven't." Ra's is smiling because it's his favorite pupil. Like, they definitely have a relationship here. And it's a nice, clever way. And it's a very odd scene. You know, it's a very strange scene, but it's really cool. And, you know, having it deal with fear and in this way, I think, is really powerful. Now we're kind of at the, you know, League of Shadows graduation ceremony, as it were, and they're going to brand him with the League of Shadows. You know, there'll be a mark on his body. But before he can officially be inducted into them, they bring this man who we met who's in the cage before and who's been captured. And Bruce has to kill him, has to behead him. Bruce basically refuses, and we get the formation of Batman's non-killing philosophy. And Ducard says, "Your compassion is a trait your enemies will not share." And Wayne answers, "That's why it's so important. It separates us from them." They're dealing directly. Batman not killing in 21st century action movies is kind of a joke, right? Action movies, guys are killing each other. We've all grown up on movies where the hero kills dozens of people, guards and bad guys and whatever, right? And Batman has retained this anachronistic thing, as Superman does, where they don't kill. You know, the two DC heroes, which I think makes them very interesting because it's very challenging as a writer to get around this. And so they deal with this straight on by giving you his philosophy right there. And it's great. And at that moment, he also learns that what they're grooming him to do is to lead the rest of these ninjas back to Gotham and destroy the city. And we get this little bit of the League of Shadows history, you know, that like Constantinople and Rome, they perform this function of, you know, destroying civilizations that get too corrupt. They finally get to it, and Bruce is like, he looks at Ducard, and he's like, "No." And Ducard's like, "For your own sake, there's no turning back." And we get a sense that if he doesn't do it, Ducard's going to have to kill him. Instead, Bruce flips the brand up over his back to a part in the upper level of the compound where there are explosives. The compound begins to burn down. The other ninjas are trying to escape. He immediately knocks Ducard unconscious and now has a duel with who we believe is Ra's al Ghul, Ken Watanabe. they're fighting, and it's a really cool sword fight. It's shot pretty well, and slowly the compound is coming apart around it. At some point, a beam falls from above and kills Roz, and we see, you know, his eyes are open and blood's coming out of his mouth, so Roz is dead. And then Bruce saves Ducard. They both jump sort of out of the compound while it's exploding. You know, Ducard goes over the cliff, but Bruce holds on to him and brings him back over, and then leaves him with a local. The guy's like, "I'll tell him you saved your life," and off he goes. And then the next shot, we don't know how much time has passed, but we see Bruce walking towards a private jet on some tarmac, and Alfred is at the top of the stairs, and on the plane back towards Gotham, we now get the sense that he's now coming back to Gotham and he's going to fight crime. But we hear him speak about, you know, "As a man, I can be ignored and discredited." He's like, "But as a symbol, I can be incorruptible and everlasting." And he's borrowing the ideas from the League of Shadows that he thinks are valuable, right? And the quote that he gives is, Alfred asks him, "A symbol, what symbol?" And he says, "Something elemental and terrifying." And Alfred says, quote, "This symbol is a persona to protect the ones you love from reprisals." So we get the sense of why, and this is right back to Falcone, you know? So it's, again, this film is so incredibly put together like a watch. And we learn that he's been gone 7 years. He's been declared dead by Earl, who's taking Wayne Enterprises public as a corporation. So, you know, it'll be owned by the public. That Wayne has been declared dead, legally dead. Esteemably that Earl could make some executive decisions with the company. But as Bruce has left everything that he owned to Alfred, you know, nothing's been lost. I'm going to pause here just because we're 43 minutes into this film and we have been given an enormous amount of information. I mean, there's one thing that Nolan decided to do in this film is to, this film is made up of an enormous amount of short scenes that are packed full of information. So the amount of story, you know, what we just saw done in a more leisurely pace could be a movie, you know, could be a movie in itself, could be part one of Batman Begins trilogy, you know. The amount of character information and plot, you know, we've developed Bruce as a young man. We've, we're given all these little seeds and Easter eggs that are going to pop up in the story later on. We've addressed parts of his character, parts of, you know, what will develop into Batman's character. Like, it's so dense with information. It's just, and, you know, only I believe because of the elegiac sense that has been creeping into this film, mostly because of Zimmer, and also because of the way Nolan shoots certain scenes, that there's a sense of elegy underneath all this, that they get away with it, that this just hasn't been a 43-minute info dump. There's been some beauty in it, some character development, the dual narratives, how much the information they packed into 43 minutes still astonishes me to this day. So now we begin the plot of the film in earnest. So we meet Dr. Jonathan Crane, played creepily by Cillian Murphy, not sure how you pronounce his name. And he's testifying to allow some killer by the name of Zaz, who straight out of the Batman comics. Zaz is famous for marking on his body every kill, so his entire body is covered with little hash marks, keeping score of people he's killed. So Crane is testifying that he's insane and that he wants to get him moved to Arkham Asylum, which is another Batman world classic, the Arkham Asylum facility. And now we're reintroduced to Rachel Dawes, who as an adult is now the high-powered assistant DA for Gotham City. Once the trial is over, we see Dawes following Crane outside and hectoring him, alleging corruption. You know, the story we get is that Crane's getting Falcone's thugs off of jail time and into Arkham Asylum, where he can, you know, can kind of be in what she calls a country club. Rachel's comment to him is the inciting incident of the middle section of this film, which I'll call the Carmine Falcone story. The initial 42 minutes is the creation of the genesis of Batman. The middle third is Batman coming into sort of his own, Carmine Falcone as his main antagonist. And the last third is the Ra's al Ghul story. So we're back at Wayne Manor and Bruce is sitting in the living room. He's been going over combing the streets. We see some intercut shots of him undercover, sort of learning the city. You know, he's kind of milling around in the city. We don't know how long he's been back, but not too long. Getting a feel for who's who, and we see him circle the picture of Gordon, so he knows who Gordon is. A bat finds its way into the living room, and Alfred tells him that they nest somewhere on the grounds, which of course we know. So Bruce follows it down, he goes back into the old well where he fell as a child, and this time you know, he willingly goes through the hole that the bats came out of. And this is a wonderful, again, thematic metaphor of this character. You know, as someone who has grown now to face his fear, he is now stepping into the very heart of where his fear has come from. In this wonderful scene, he walks in, and we see that he's in this much larger cave, and the bats all converge around him, and he immediately cowers down, and then slowly he gets his bearings and rises up, and his arms go out, and he's completely at peace, and the bats are all around him. Thematically, he has stepped inside his fear now, for real. I mean, back in his place where, you know, this began, he's come full circle. And now he's standing inside it looking out. And it's awesome thematically. I mean, come on. You know, what a cool way to put a theme forward. So now, because of Rachel, Crane goes to Falcone and basically says there's a DA sniffing around, take care of her. But we also get a sense that Falcone's been arranging for some kind of shipments to be brought into Gotham for Crane. He's saying something about, we've been paying you for that. And so, you know, it's the beginning of sort of the Crane-Falcone plot, which will lead, you know, eventually lead back to Ra's, but not yet. So now we come into the scene, the film, where sort of the creation of Batman. And, you know, Bruce Wayne emerges into society. He makes his appearance that he's not dead, and he appears at a boardroom meeting of Wayne Enterprises. And when Rutger Hauer's Earl comes out to see why his secretary isn't answering his calls, and he sees Bruce, the reaction's wrong. This is an unbelievable surprise, and he takes it way too coolly. So I thought I had a little nit with that. They have a brief chat. He welcomes Bruce back, and he's like, what would you like to do in your company? By the way, it's going public. And Bruce is like, I don't want to get in the way of that. It's cool. You know, I'm not a threat. He has eyed the Applied Sciences division of Wayne Enterprises as a place where he might like to work. And he says, oh, Fox's old division, I'll tell him you're coming. And so the next shot, he's down in Applied Sciences, and he meets Lucius Fox, played by Morgan Freeman. We find out that Fox is a friend of his dad's, helped him build the train system. You know, so sort of this good guy from nowhere who appears. And he's been, you know, basically thrown into this dead-end area called Applied Sciences, and we get a sense that it's where the dumping ground for all the prototypes for all these things that Wayne Enterprise has invented and developed but didn't sell for one reason or another. So it's a brilliant way for Bruce walks in to this wonderful garden of toys, as it were. We can't wait till he starts picking them up. What we're also getting is his father's legacy, you know, like the stethoscope, the fact that his father created this company, and now that Bruce has all these toys to use in his fight against crime, you know, it's sort of the gift of his father to him and the legacy that represents. Immediately, we're introduced to the real-life applications of what Batman will use, like the elegiac moments in this film, like the short scenes, like the film going straight at, you know, Batman's character traits that we know so well. It goes right at all the things that Batman will wear. I mean, it leaves no stone unturned. And in this time down there, we are introduced to the gas-powered grapple gun. And there's this Kevlar utility harness, which is the bat belt, as it were, you know, and this wonderful body armor. It's all explained and extrapolated. You know, we hear the word Kevlar, right? We know what Kevlar is. And we get a sense that all this stuff is fairly realistic. It's very high tech. The gas-powered grapple gun, I mean, who knows if that really exists. But it's not just a grapple gun. It's a gas-powered grapple gun. So it's everything has a ring of reality to it. And again, I think that's what, you know, one of the things that makes this movie so great. Back at Wayne Manor, Bruce and Alfred are exploring the caves a little bit more, and they get some way into the cave. It's this huge cave, and they see that it's connected to the underground wing of one of the wings of Wayne Manor. Then we get this little bit of information from Alfred that when your great-grandfather used to, you know, run, he was part of the Underground Railroad. Enough already with the Waynes being rich people who you don't hate, you know, like they're so careful to make this exceedingly old money, wealthy family do-gooders from way back. Like, oh, your great grandfather helped free slaves and your father was a doctor and he loved people. It's like, it was corny in a way that I didn't like, but again, it's a nit. But the cool thing is, there's an old elevator that no one knew about that leads up into, you know, a drawing room in Wayne Manor. So a little bit of a wink and nod to the Batman TV show. I don't know if this was a factor in the older Batman comics. I don't know much about Batman prior to 1986 in comic world, frankly. So could be that as well. So then we get a brief, like, armoring montage. He's spraying his outfit black, and he's making stuff, and he's cutting out the little batarangs from the metal. And, you know, we're beginning to get him ramped up to his full Batman potential. And then, so this leads to what I call the first Batman's first outing. What I love about this is that he's a mess his first time out, right? He doesn't have any cowl. He doesn't have his cape. He doesn't have the Batmobile. He just has what he took from Wayne Enterprises, which is the body armor, the utility belt, and the grapple gun. We cut to Gordon, Detective Flass. And I think it's the first time we meet Flass. And Flass is straight from year one, Frank Miller, bent cop. Flass is on the take. We get a sense that Gordon is not. Gordon's doing his little Serpico routine, and Gordon's clean. And so Bruce's first mission, Gordon goes back to his office. The lights go out. Bruce is behind him, and he clicks a stapler and puts it to the back of Gordon's head to make Gordon think that he's got a gun. And he's hoping to enlist Gordon in his fight. So he's asking why no one takes down Falcone. Gordon gives him the information that he's bought and paid with the right people, tells Bruce that what you need is leverage on Judge Faden and a prosecutor willing to take the case. And so he mentions Rachel's name, and then he takes off. But Gordon turns around and realizes that he hasn't gone far, and he sees him kind of, he looks up, and Bruce is climbing up the fire escape to get to the roof. Gordon takes the elevator there and gets there just as Bruce does. He tells him to freeze. Bruce runs and jumps off the building, grabs onto a fire escape of a nearby building, and he barely makes it. The fire escape collapses, and it's very sloppy. Like, he's a mess. Like, his first time out, he didn't know what the hell he was doing, and he barely got away with his life the very first time he tried to, quote, you know, play Batman. And I like that. And what's great about this is we also see what he needs. He needs a way to, if he's going to leap off buildings, he needs a way to break his fall and to direct himself and so on and so forth. So again, this movie is insanely put together in terms of sort of layering and, you know, one thing leading to another and how incredibly dense it is, packed with information. Directly from this, he returns to Fox, and there's this funny little moment of like, what is it this time? He's like, this time it's base jumping, you know, and Fox is like, you know, I don't know what you're doing. There's this great energy between him and Fox where, you know, Fox is not a big fan of Earl, so he'll pretty much do whatever Bruce wants, but he's like, look, I'm not an idiot. And Bruce is like, fair enough. He needs some kind of parachutic-like material, and we get this great thing called memory cloth where, you know, you run a current through a type of cloth and it's sort of the molecules align. And there's some real science behind this. Very speculative, right? But very cool. And so what's going to happen is that this will be his cape. Like, his cape is not just a cape that Nolan and David Goyer sat around and were like, every bit of his costume has to work and it has to matter. And his cape becomes sort of like his built-in, you know, glide suit or parachute suit. And, you know, the physics aren't right when he's jumping off buildings. Like, he wouldn't glide the way he does in the movie. But it's damn cool, and it makes a lot of sense. And they use it to really good effect. So very impressed with that. And then, of course, they come across what they call the Tumbler, and it's the new Batmobile. And the Tumbler is amazing. I will repeat, the Tumbler is amazing. We get this, you know, story about it being a bridging vehicle, even though it's kind of a stupid idea. That, you know, it jumps over a river and towing cables. But it's worked into the plot because it does that twice in the story. And so they give it a realistic background for its ability to do those things in the story, which is just amazing, you know. There's a Batmobile documentary. If you have some of the extended or special edition sets of the Dark Knight trilogy, there's a great Batmobile documentary. And they really built this thing. And what's great is you can tell. And it's a nasty looking thing. Like, it looks really cool, and it's real, man. And it's burly looking. There's no goofy fins on it. There's nothing that says like Batmobile in any way. Like, it's just this brutal, amazing vehicle. And just kudos to the design team for the Batmobile, because they could have gone wrong. It's, you know, this is a kind of moment in the film that like a Joel Schumacher film would have been like, you know, a Ferrari with bat wings on it, right? But they went for realism. Like, it's a tank for all intents and purposes. I mean, it's so brutal looking. These are the kind of choices that they continually make in the film that keeps it curving back towards reality, that he's driving this very fast tank. And that's the Batmobile. You never hear the word Batmobile, right? It's the Tumbler. And very smart, very smart. I think there's a brief shout out to the TV show, because there's one point in the Tumbler when it speeds up and does its turbo thing, there's a small hole in the back and flames shoot out of it, and it reminded me of the 1966 TV series Batmobile. And I'm just wondering if Nolan, you know, it was a little nod and a wink, because if Nolan's like my age, he would have seen it, you know. So anyway, I have no idea. Then we get this discussion between Falcone and Flass, something about like a last shipment that's coming in. And Flass mentions that he's going to, you know, he's going to contract the job of killing Rachel. At that point, we see that Bruce has been trailing Flass and he's listening in with some kind of sonic surveillance device. And they quickly cut back to the Batcave, and we see that this device will fit inside the Batman cowl that he will wear. It has these two spikes coming up, as most of Batman's costumes do. But the Nolans have done it again, and Goyer, who knows? These are actual antennas that Batman uses to surveil, you know. And they show you putting this little sort of thing inside the spike, and it will house the surveillance equipment. And what a genius idea! And gives it purpose. Like, you know, they're not just head spikes to make him look crazy, make him look scary, which he wants to do anyway. They have a purpose, you know. And again, I just love that it goes into so much. Then there's a final montage of Bruce completing his preparations. He has the cowl now. He's got the cape, assuming he's, you know, learned how to fly it because he's, you know, right out of the gate, he knows what to do. And now Batman is coalescing into a fully formed crime fighter who has everything he needs, all of his gadgets and all of his, you know, weapons and techniques. And so this ends sort of the preparation sequence of the film. And so there's sort of another graduation of this. There's a big takedown of Falcone that happens in one evening. It starts out at the docks, and Falcone's in a limousine with Flass and a limo driver up front. They're there ostensibly to supervise the last shipment. This is one place in the film where I think they went off, in that, you know, Falcone would never, a crime boss would never be anywhere near the scene of any kind of crime like this. He might drive by briefly for a quick checkout, but he wouldn't sit there in the car waiting until all the, you know, the drugs were loaded onto other trucks and everything. And it's a huge plot flaw. It's very stupid. They need to get Falcone there in order to get him into prison to get arrested. So, you know, elaborately to get a crime boss caught, like in any kind of movie, if it's even quasi-realistically, takes an enormous amount of resources. And I understand that the writers didn't have all day, basically. But it's a big flaw, so I need to mention it. So we hear some brief scuttlebutt about most of the drugs going to dealers, some special drugs going to what they say, quote, the man in the narrows. Then now we're in the sort of warehouse district area. And this is Batman's first, you know, real good test. And he's coming from up on high and just snatching guys, pulling them up, knocking guys out. He's taking lights out with his batarang. Like, he's pretty much supremely badass in this moment. There's some great takedowns here. They're all so very sudden. And there's some good tension. Nolan takes his time with some of these scenes. These are probably the longest takes in the film, where guys are slowly walking around corners where all these crates and containers are sitting. We don't know where Batman's going to come from next. And he really does. He pulls his hand back and he allows the tension to build, which is nice. So there's this great scene where a guy's screaming, "Where are you?" And the camera moves a little bit to the left and Batman's hanging upside down behind him. Very cool. So then this scene kind of comes to a close. Falcone gets out of the limo. The rest of the sort of thugs are in one area. So Batman finally lands and he begins to take them all out. This fight scene is shot like the other fight scene sort of in the Chinese prison. It's all done for effect. You can't really tell what the hell's going on. And I think in this case, the Nolans did it on purpose. Like, from Falcone's point of view, all he saw was this black figure in a cape, blurry, taking his guys down one by one. He wasn't sure what he was seeing. It was all happening so fast. And that's okay, but I hate blizzard of cuts fight scenes in movies. They disorient me. I get thrown out of the film, so, you know, whatever. So he takes them all down, and then we follow Falcone back into the limo, and he's panicking. He's trying to load his weapon, and Batman, you know, smashes through from the sunroof, pulls him up, and because Falcone had said right before that, you know, "What the hell are you?" And he goes, "I'm Batman." And in that moment, Batman has arrived fully. In that moment, he sees again Raid Shabigdia, who early in the film he exchanged coats with, and he goes, "Nice coat." And Raid realizes that it's this young kid. You know, he doesn't know who he is, obviously, but it's a fun moment. Then we cut to later that same evening. Rachel's getting out of a subway, and two guys are converging on her who are going to kill her, basically. She shrugs off one of them and turns towards the other. And behind her, Batman takes the guy out, and the guy in front of her sees Batman and runs away. And of course, she thinks it's him, and she's like, "You better run." Turns around, sees Batman. And there's this nice little thing where she tases him, And he allows the tase to kind of happen, but it's stuck in his armor. It doesn't faze him at all, and he knocks it out. Basically, in this scene, he gives her the leverage she needs on the judge. Then this is the first time where she looks up and he's vanished, and he's doing his famous thing. So back at the docks, Gordon's there with all the cops. A patrolman comes up to Gordon and he's like, "Oh, you know, Falcone's men." He's like, "Yeah, who cares? We'll never tie him to it." Rightly so. And the guy's like, "I'm not sure about that." And so what Batman has done is chained Falcone to a large sort of Klieg light, searchlight, and the flaps, and he turns it on, and the flaps from his coat, when they all look up at the light hitting the clouds, it's sort of a, you know, prototype bat signal. And he had said this to Gordon right before he left when he was at the police station, you know, "Look for my sign." So, you know, there it was. Very clever, you know, the first one was Carmine Falcone. And then from here, they cut briefly to this other pop grandeur moment in this movie that's just beautiful. The Hans Zimmer score is swelling up, and camera is now tracking around a very tall building. And Batman is sort of on the corner of one of these buildings as if a real live gargoyle. And he's just cowled and caped and there watching. It's basically a montage, and we hear the music and the camera sweeps by him, and it is awesome. It is the Batman from the comic books, like as close as you're ever going to get. And Nolan just nails it. So the morning after, we get a brief scene of the police, you know, the police station, that Loeb is like, you know, he's now Commissioner Loeb, and he's like, "No one takes the law into their own hands in my city. Everyone's after him." Rachel shows her boss all the information that Bruce gave her, and they're going to go ahead and prosecute Falcone, who is in jail. And then Bruce is woken up by Alfred, and we see all these bruises on him. And then we start to get into why the Bruce Wayne Playboy persona was developed. And we get these great lines from Alfred. "You know, you're going to have to learn how to play polo." He's like, "I'm not learning polo, Alfred." He's like, "Strange injuries, a non-existent social life." He's like, "You know, people are going to start to worry. What does Bruce Wayne do with his time and with his money?" And Bruce realizes that Alfred is right. You know, he's not going to last long incognito if he doesn't put up some kind of front. So, you know, this is the notion of the billionaire playboy that he will have to adopt. So now we're entering the last part of the film, the last third. This is the return of Ra's al Ghul story. So it starts off by a scene in Wayne Enterprises with Earl, and he finds out that something they're calling a microwave emitter has been taken from Wayne Enterprises, a ship that was bringing it, I guess, back to Gotham or delivering it. And you get a scene that's intercut with managers explaining to him that it's been stolen. We see the scene on the boat where these two figures, you know, enter the boat and turn this machine on. And as they turn it on, you know, water starts steaming up from everywhere and pipes start busting. So it's an odd little machine. And, you know, at this point in the movie, we don't really know what it's going to be used for. So then we get our first emergence of, you know, the billionaire playboy persona. Bruce comes to a hotel and a restaurant, and he's sitting with a bunch of people. And, of course, they're talking about Batman, and, you know, he has some funny lines. Two of the women he's with, you know, are swimming in sort of this fountain area that's really not for swimming, and he falls in as well. And then he buys the hotel. Like, he really gets into it. And on his way out, he's walking out, you know, wet, in a towel, and he runs into Rachel. We don't know where she's going, but they haven't seen each other since he's been back. And so there's this wonderful meet and greet. She's busy. At this point, unfortunately, her character becomes very much a scold. You know, he's off having fun, and she's, of course, like, you know, her thankless job in trying to save the city. And she's, like, always, like, scolding him for his playboy ways. And of course, obviously, they built her character this way. But the way the actress handles it, she becomes a bit of a scold. And, you know, I ceased liking her, even though I love the character. I stopped liking her because she just, from here on out, she's just constantly morally scolding Batman. Like, "Some of us have work to do, Bruce," which she says later. And it's all about, you know, she's working, she's saving the city. And she comes off as a bit of a scold. But we do get an important line that she delivers, because Bruce feels in that moment that, like, "Oh my God, you know, I'm putting on this whole persona and this woman who I love." And the love story between them is badly underdeveloped. I mean, they knew each other as children, and then he briefly came back when he was a young adult and then left. So they have there's no connection to them as adults. So the love story between them is kind of absurd. But so he's like, "Rachel, you know, there's more. This isn't really me." She's like, "It's not who you are underneath, Bruce, but what you do that defines you." And her delivery of the line is very unflattering, and it's, you know, the line will come into play later on. We then get a scene between Falcone and Crane in prison. Falcone has cut his wrists as a ploy to get Crane in to see him. And he's like, look, you know, whatever we got to do, get me out of here. You know, get me into Arkham. No, so when Crane comes to see him, he's like, look, I know you guys are planning something big, and I want in. And Crane's like, you don't know anything. He's like, I know you're experimenting on the inmates of the Nut House, and I know that you don't want the cops to look too deeply at the drugs that they seized. He's like, I know enough. Crane quite coldly is like, when he, quote, he gets here. So there's some third player in this that we don't know about, but the way he's spoken about is these odd, hushed tones by these two heavyweight bad guys. So we don't know who this person is. You know, astute viewers, I'm sure, will understand that somehow Ducard is coming back in some way. So very callously, he's like, yeah, I think he'd just say we kill you. And he's like, you can't get me in here, not in my town. And Crane realizes that, so he doses him with his fear toxin, making Falcone catatonic so he can transfer him to Arkham and kill him. And this is the first time the villain persona of Scarecrow emerges. Crane takes his mask out, and it's a really cool mask. And it's a great way the villain emerges, is that he's kind of a sick dude, and that he doses these patients and then puts the Scarecrow mask on and like terrorizes them. And it's fucked up, you know, but it's Murphy carries it off, you know, he really carries it off. And, you know, having him be a Batman villain and having the villain come into the movie in that way, I think it's great. Like, he's a psychiatrist who's messed up, and, you know, he likes to play these games with his patients, and that's Scarecrow. And I think it's really cool, and I think it works, frankly. So then we get a scene at night. You know, Gordon's taking out his garbage. Batman is waiting for him, and they have this brief scene about, you know, the drugs, that there's some drugs going to this man in the Narrows that Flash knows. Gordon's like, Flash's not going to talk, and of course Batman says he'll talk to me. It's a nice moment where he does the disappearing trick on Gordon, and Gordon's like, you know, I've been wrong before about, you know, trusting people. And then there's this great interrogation scene with Flash where Flash is walking down a rainy alley and he steps in this trap that Batman has left, and he's reeled up like 7 or 8 flights upside down to see this, you know, murderously enraged Batman screaming at him like, where are the drugs? It's really kind of unnerving. Bale really sells it. It's really amazing, actually. And he drops him down once and then pulls him up again. And Flash doesn't know. You know, it's weird. I don't know why this scene is in the film, because he doesn't get any information from Flash. He knew as much, I think, going to interrogate Flash, that the drugs were somehow brought somewhere in the Narrows. So, I don't know. Just an interesting. Maybe there's something else that I don't understand about this scene that happened that I don't recognize. But it's still kind of cool, the way he interrogates him. So maybe they left it in for that. And then we get this brief scene of Rachel's boss, who is investigating a crate that has come in on a container ship that wasn't listed in the manifest. And he's got two guys from the sort of docks with him. He goes to open the container. He's killed. And the camera briefly shows us that the microwave emitter is in that crate. So it has arrived. So then we cut to Batman investigating the Narrows. And we get our first shot of what the Narrows is. The Narrows is like, you know, if you live in New York City, it's kind of an expanded Governor's Island. It's like, it's an island in the middle of the city. And there are bridges, you know, reaching out to it on both sides. But it's this poverty-ridden shanty town. Like, and it really is designed really cool. It just looks run down. There's kind of steam coming off of it. I mean, it looks like it's, you know, a little third world country kind of stuck in the middle of this metropolis. And Batman is basically roaming around the Narrows with this little infrared periscope, looking into apartments and basically looking for the drugs. Come in these little rabbits, and we got that info, you know, from when Falcone was supervising the drug shipment, that the rabbits go to the man in the Narrows. So he's looking for, you know, an empty apartment with these rabbits in it, and he finally finds it. And some young boy comes out onto the fire escape. His parents are arguing. He comes out and he sees Batman. He's like, oh my God, everyone's talking about you. No one will ever believe me. And Batman throws him the periscope. And part of me was thinking that this is a setup for Robin, because you see this kid again later on. And that, they, you know, if they had an idea of maybe doing Robin, that they planted that seed here. I don't know. It's kind of interesting. So Batman enters the apartment. He's examining the rabbits, and the door opens and he hides. Crane and his men are there to kind of retrieve the drugs. And Batman incapacitates one of the guys in the bathroom. And Crane's men are, you know, they're basically, they took the drugs and they're soaking the apartment in gasoline, and they're going to set it on fire. So Batman emerges out to sort of take them down, but Crane's been expecting him, and he hits him with a dose of his fear gas. Batman is immediately affected. He's kind of, you know, he loses it, and he's stunned. And in that moment, Crane dumps a bottle of gas on him and lights him on fire. Like, it's a great moment between the first time where we see these two sort of superhero, supervillain clash. And it's very realistic that because Crane knew he was there, he was ready for him. He stuns him with the gas, lights him on fire, and then there's this beautiful scene as Batman has to jump out of the apartment into the rain, and we see this sort of fiery, angelic figure falling. It's a very cool shot. We also see from Batman's point of view that his fear visions have kicked up again, and we see these bats coming out of Crane's mouth. Really creepy, these hallucinogenic scenes. So he puts himself out on the ground, and he's rolling around, steaming, and people are starting to gather to look at him, and so he grappling guns himself up to the roof and calls Alfred, and in the next scene, we see him in the back of this car. Alfred has come to get him. Then we cut to in the morning. He's been out for 2 days. You know, Fox has been brought in by Alfred to synthesize an antidote for what happened to him, so now Fox is sort of in on his Batman persona. And seemingly, there's a moment where Bruce is like, oh, shit. But Fox is now taking on sort of the mythical persona of the hero's armorer, if you will. And so he's kind of part of the team now. It happens to be his birthday that morning, and he's going to have this huge party at his house. And Rachel briefly comes to visit, and she gives him a present. Again, we get this scold part of her. So we find out that she's not coming to his party because her boss is missing. And she's like, some of us have work to do, Bruce. You enjoy your party. It's badly delivered, and you know we don't like her for saying it. As us watching the film. And then she briefly gets a phone call and finds out that Crane has Falcone transferred to Arkham. It's important because Bruce realizes she's heading there now. So she takes off in her car. He basically tells Alfred, entertain the guests, I'll be back. And he sort of sets off in pursuit of her. So there's a brief shot of Earl coming down to Applied Sciences and confronting Fox about the microwave emitter. And Fox is like, what did you lose one? And Earl fires him on the spot. So then we cut to Arkham, and Rachel is at Arkham Asylum confronting Crane about Falcone. She looks into the room that Falcone's in, and he's Scarecrow. You know, he's still on Crane's toxin. And she doesn't buy a minute of it. She kind of intuits that he drugged him to get him there. You know, she's very haughty and very unaware of her danger. And she's like, you know, I'm getting a doctor here tonight and bringing someone down to examine him. This is bullshit. The Crane realizes that the jig is up, so instead of letting her go, he takes her down to this basement area where we see a whole crew of men pouring this substance into the city's water supply. We're not really sure yet what it is, and then he doses her like a very intense version of the toxin, and she sort of passes out. And in that moment, the lights go out, and we realize that Batman is there, and he's been following this whole thing and realizes she's in trouble. And Crane knows it's Batman. It's kind of a great scene where Crane's like, it's the Batman, and Murphy's great. So there's this great point of, you know, Batman comes into the basement. These great scenes where he's picking guys off from up out of nowhere. You know, he kills the lights and there's great suspense and he's taking guys down. And finally, he gets Crane and he gives Crane a dose of his own fear toxin. And then it's this great scene where we see Batman as Crane is looking at him jacked up on his fear toxin. And it's like Batman's face is, it's almost as if he's not wearing a mask, like the Batman mask has melded into his face, and his whole face is like this deep black. There's this ooze coming out of his mouth. Like, it's a terrifying scene. And we see that this is Crane's fear, that Batman represents like this incredibly demonic and horrible, horrible specter. Gotta give it to Nolan, man. It comes out of nowhere. These hallucinogenic effects are really cool when they're used in this film. And again, it gives this film that extra sense of something else going on with it, where it's just not a pure action film. And it's just, oh God, it's so creepy looking. Crane eventually loses it, but he tells Batman that someone named Ra's al Ghul is behind it all. And Batman's like, Ra's al Ghul is dead. You know, who are you working for? And at that point, you know, supposedly Crane's mind snaps and he can talk no longer. So the police converge on Arkham, and Batman has taken Rachel upstairs now in like one of the higher levels of the facility. You know, they're all outside and they're waiting for SWAT, and Gordon goes in alone, and Batman snatches him up basically, and Gordon's given the particulars of what's going on. While this is happening, the SWAT team is sort of entering into Arkham, and then we see Batman activate this thing on his foot, and Gordon's like, what is that sound? And we hear this little sound, and he's like, back up. And the hypersonic homing device has basically called the bats out of the Batcave, and they've all converged on Arkham. And it's awesome, and it's right out of the Batman Year One storyline. Frank Miller uses it, so it's basically taken, you know, almost shot for shot out of that book, and but used to wonderful effect because everyone is cowering down as the bats are, you know, all over the place. And so Gordon and Batman are able to kind of sneak out of Arkham, you know, without having to interact with anybody. And so they're both outside in the alley. Gordon's like, I'll get my car. And there's this great line where Batman's like, I've brought mine. And he sees Batman drive off in the Batmobile and you know, in the Tumbler, I should say. And now we're in for our car chase. So now we have the Tumbler chase scene. As I may have shared in an earlier podcast, I hate car chase scenes in films. But this one's pretty clever. And mostly it's because what the Tumbler can do is exploited during the chase. So it starts out where, you know, he's being chased by helicopters and cops. He goes up to the top of a parking garage and they think they have him cornered and launches off the roof of the garage onto neighboring roofs. So he lands on one's roof, then another roof. There's some nice comic effect going on because the cops are like making wisecracks about like it's a black tank. Where is he? He's like, he's on rooftops. So, you know, we're getting some good comedy. But the music is, you know, fairly serious and intense. You know, we can see that he's using some of the technology in the car to do these amazing things. And, you know, we got the initial setup in the film that this was a bridging vehicle, right? So what does it do? It jumps is what it does. So he jumps onto several rooftops with the straight-ahead aim of shortcutting to the freeway, which is kind of cool. You know, it actually makes some sense. So he gets on the freeway, and he's being chased. And at one point, now evening, he goes into the Tumbler, goes into stealth mode, and he shuts down all the lights and, like, hits the brakes. The helicopter loses him, so he's not spotlighted anymore. So the helicopter takes off. So he's lost the copter, but Rachel's starting to fade. He turns everything back on. The cops are still with him. He eventually loses them all and in a last final moment, you know, jumps into the waterfall, which you've seen earlier from the other side of the Batcave. And it's a, you know, the waterfall is basically the entrance to the Batcave. And it doesn't last forever either, so it's pretty cool. So now we cut to the basement of Arkham Asylum where a technician is telling Gordon that Crane's guys have been dumping toxin into the water supply for weeks. The city's entire water supply is laced with this drug. And then the tech makes a leap that makes no sense because Gordon's like, well, you know, how come, you know, we haven't been seeing any effects of this? And the tech goes, well, maybe it's a compound that has to be absorbed in the lungs. Like, he's only made to say that by the screenplay because that's exactly what's going to happen because of the microwave emitter. And, you know, so it's a little goofy, a little on the nose and incorrect in terms of, you know, what characters know. But, you know, again, it's a nit. So now we'll cut back to the Batcave. Rachel wakes up, and of course, Bruce is still in costume. And he tells her, you've been inoculated against the gas. Here's two vials. Give one to Gordon. The other one's for mass production. Gives her a sedative, and then goes up into the mansion. He gets dressed up in his tux and tells Alfred to take Rachel home. So now we're in the end game, and this is the last act of the film. And, you know, basically the arrival and revelation of the identity of Ra's al Ghul, you know, Bruce's, Batman's battle against these, you know, enemies of Gotham. When Bruce comes back, basically Alfred's really angry at him because he's seen the Tumbler on television. And he's basically, you know, we get him coming at Bruce like, you're reckless, you're doing this, you're getting caught up in this role. You know, and he has a real explanation. It's like, you know, it was Rachel and she was dying. I had to get her back to the Batcave. And you realize that this was a tack on of the screenplay. You know, Alfred being the part of his family now, which he's about to betray, actually, in the main room of Wayne Manor, being scolded by sort of the avatar of his dad. And it's wrong. It doesn't, it's kind of an odd note. Now we get Bruce entering into his party. It's his birthday. And several things happen here that are significant. The first one is he bumps into Earl. We hear about the IPO of Wayne Enterprises. It went well. Everyone's rich. Everybody's happy. We cut to outside. Alfred is putting Rachel in the car to drive her home. Then back into the party, Bruce comes across Lucius Fox and finds out about the microwave emitter. And he puts together sort of the, you know, the toxin in the water has to be absorbed in the lungs. The microwave emitter kind of gets some notion of what the plan might be. And he sends Fox back to Wayne Enterprises to start synthesizing an antidote. And then we have the big reveal in the film that Ducard, who, you know, was Liam Neeson back in the early part of the movie, really was what Ra's al Ghul, not the Asian guy who we thought was Ra's al Ghul. And it's a great moment where some party guest comes up to Bruce. It's like, oh, Bruce, I have to introduce you to someone. Now, am I pronouncing your name right? Is it Ra's al Ghul? And an Asian man with a blue flower on his lapel turns around. Bruce says, you're not Ra's al Ghul. Ra's al Ghul is dead. I watched him die. And then we hear Liam Neeson's voice. Ah, but is Ra's al Ghul immortal? Are his methods supernatural? And then Bruce picks up the thread and goes, or cheap parlor tricks to disguise your true identity, Ra's. So, and Ducard kind of nods at him as, yes, this is me. So now we get the whole plot. You know, we get the big Nolan-esque, on-the-nose exposition. And basically, you know, what's happened is Ra's al Ghul at one point and head of the League of Shadows, they tried to take Gotham down using what they call modern techniques, economics. So they were the ones who sort of took Gotham down when Bruce was a kid and created, you know, Joe Chill and the conditions that allowed a guy like Falcone to thrive. But when his parents died, you know, their death shocked the city and it's been sort of limping on ever since. Did not die, and now the League is back to do the job. So it's very clever for the writers because at first Bruce's main enemy is Joe Chill. Then it escalates to his main enemy being Falcone, and Falcone's sort of his presence creating Joe Chill's. And now we back it off again that basically Ra's al Ghul, in a sense, created the entire situation where both of them would operate, and that, you know, though he wasn't able to have vengeance against Chill, this is really the guy behind his parents' death. And I think it's very clever in the film to have the antagonist continually be slipping away, and finally it's revealed. And this is the guy that, you know, that Batman really wants to take down for some sense of closure for his parents. So what happens is that he wants to protect all the people in his house who are there as guests. So he makes believe he's drunk and an asshole, and, you know, throws them out, basically. You know, calls them suck-ups and sycophants, and, you know, throws them all out, basically soils his family name, but for a good cause, so these people won't be killed. And while Ra's is explaining, after they leave, Ra's is explaining the plot, the rest of the League guys are burning down the house, basically. And so by the time, you know, the explanation is over and he and Ra's come to blows, the place is coming down around him. Like when Ra's, the Asian guy playing Ra's in the beginning of the film, was knocked out by a falling timber, Bruce is also knocked out by falling timber. And at that moment, you know, Ra's is like, you can tell he still has some feelings for his old pupil, even though he's always told Bruce that compassion is his undoing. That he says out loud, you know, justice is balance. You burned down my house and left me for dead. You know, I'll do the same. So, and it makes, like, the writers are smart because it gives us a real reason why Ra's doesn't kill Bruce right there, because there's no other thing for him. Like, he knows that Bruce is incredibly dangerous and well-funded. Like, you don't leave a guy like that around when an incredibly intricate plan is going together. You kill him. You know, as his former pupil, a little bit of compassion was there left in him and allowed him to live. So, again, very subtle but very important. Now, at this time, part of the League of Shadows plan is to set off the microwave emitter in the Narrows and let all the inmates out of Arkham and, like, begin the terror at Ground Zero, you know, which would eventually spread through the city. And so they do that, and we see, you know, all these people being let out of Arkham, all these criminals. And, you know, great setup. If they wanted to make sequels and didn't have a clear idea of what they wanted, you know, they can just, half the sequels could be tracking down some of these killers and Batman rounding them up, but they did not go in that direction. Back at Wayne Manor, Alfred knocks out two of Ra's henchmen left there to make sure Bruce doesn't survive. He rescues Bruce, and there's this funny line about all these bloody push-ups, you can't move a damn log, right? Because there's also this sort of comic canon thing of Batman doing a lot of push-ups. The joke is he doesn't have superpowers, he's just a guy who does a lot of push-ups, and there's a little nod to that in the film, which is great. So him and Alfred make it to the elevator, and they go heading down towards the Batcave, and above them, Wayne Manor, you know, is burning. And Bruce starts crying. He's like, what have I done, Alfred? My family, you know. And then Alfred goes back into the watery fall to pick ourselves up again. It's very corny and on the nose. Bruce is like, you haven't given up on me. Never. You know, we get the corny Alfred giving him what he needs. I don't know how I feel about it at that point. Then the main idea now back in the Narrows is that, you know, Gordon is there and he gets Loeb to send every available cop into the Narrows to, you know, get all these inmates that have escaped from Arkham. At the same time, Ra's is there with his folks and they turn on the microwave emitter. All of the Narrows becomes enveloped in this fear toxin. So everyone except for Ra's men and Ra's, who are masked and Rachel and Gordon, who are inoculated. Everyone else is affected by this gas. And so we get a lot of those, again, hallucinogenic effects from a lot of people's point of view. And you see people with weird ghostly, like skull-like faces and weird lighting effects. Like, it's really cool. And there's this one moment where Flash is sort of cornering some people. And the kids he's cornering have white eyes. Like, it's really creepy. Then we get this one moment of really great superhero cinema where Gordon's on the island and he's talking to Loeb, who's off the island, and he's telling Loeb, I need, you know, you've got to send more men to the island. We got to take this place. And Loeb's like, Gordon, every man, every available body is on that island. And Gordon's like, well, they're completely incapacitated. So am I on my own? And then the music swells, and then Batman in the tumbler shoots across the open bridge, and, you know, because they can jump, right? Jumps onto the island, and it's a goosebumps moment. There's no doubt about it. I mean, they really get you, where it's like the hero has arrived, you know, and it's really cool. So then we have this brief scene where Rachel is protecting this little boy that Batman had given his periscope to a while ago. From the boy's point of view, he's looking at Scarecrow, who's riding one of the police horses, and the horse is breathing fire, and Scarecrow is rearing up. Like, it's a really cool scene. It's like, made me think of a Headless Horseman. It's really wild. And, you know, Rachel has her wonderful moment. She tases him. And after this, you know, incredible moment of where he's so powerful and scary, you know, he basically falls off his horse and, you know, screams in a very unscary-like fashion, and he's out of the fight. But then all these inmates start to surround her. She pulls a gun out of a downed cop, and the little kid's like, don't worry, Batman will save us. And of course, Batman arrives at that moment. He takes everybody down, saves them both. But then, you know, he looks off in the distance and he realizes Ra's is about to take this microwave emitter on the train. It's kind of a goofy plot. The plot is that they're going to put it on the train, turn it on, and it's going to vaporize the water in the mains all the way to the center of Wayne Tower, at which point all of the water in all of the city's mains will blow and vaporize, and the whole city will be, you know, doomed with this fear toxin. So whatever. I mean, it's clever, and I get it story-wise, but I don't know. It's kind of goofy. You know, he's sort of above where Ra's is, and he's about to jump to fly down towards him. And Rachel's like, you know, you could die. Tell me your name. And so, and he gives her line back to her. It's not what I am underneath. It's what I do that defines me. And she's like, Bruce? And then he launches himself, and we get this wonderful soundtrack cue of, like, the hero has arrived. And so he's flying overhead, and this is these are amazing, amazing shots. But all the people on the ground who are victims of this fear toxin are looking up, and they see this bat. The shots of him flying change, and all of a sudden he's like got these fiery eyes and fiery mouth, and it's like this demon flying over the city, and it's so cool, man. I mean, it's another pop grandeur moment where, because of the hallucinogenic plot element, that Nolan's able to play with visuals in this film and really, really mess around in ways that don't happen later in his later two films and a lot of other films. And he's able to do stuff visually because of that, that just make the film extra cool, you know, so it's awesome. So he finally lands, faces Ra's, and Ra's has his great line. He's like, you know, you took my suggestion about theatricality a bit literally. So they have this back and forth, and Ra's jumps up to the train car, and it starts to go. And so he beats Ra's minions, but then falls to the ground, and all of the crazed crowds start to come around him and attack him, and he's stuck. He reaches out with his grapple gun, shoots at the train that's departing, and it pulls him out. And so this is sort of the end of the film coming up. You have the train, the elevated train going, and he's stuck under the train, you know, swinging underneath it, dodging buildings, dodging metal struts. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of Keystone Cops Lucas-ish. I don't really love it. So eventually he gets up into the train car, and he has a final face-off with Ra's. They're fighting, and it's, you know, the same the way it's cut with Nolan. You don't know exactly what's going on in the fight. Like, he's not the best action director in this way so far. But there is one really cool scene where, you know, Ra's is kind of, you know, they're kind of evenly matched, and Ra's is like, you know, have you anything new for me? And he goes, how about this, Batman says, and he has Ra's sword in between two of his gauntlets, and he pulls his arms apart, and the sword shatters in two. It's really cool. So while this is going on, you know, Gordon has been given the Batmobile. You know, he's come back out of the Narrows, and he's driven all the way to Wayne Tower in order to take out the struts holding up the train rails, and so that if Batman fails to stop the train, that train will derail at the last minute, blowing up the emitter and stopping the whole process. So he does this, and at one point, Rostin gets Batman sort of on the ground, and he's like, you never thought to mind your surroundings. That line comes back. He's like, you're never going to stop this train. And Batman is like, who said anything about stopping it? And Ra's realizes what's going on. Batman gets the drop on him, but he won't kill him. But he says, I don't have to save you either. And then he opens up his wings. He blows up the back of the train with one of his explosive devices and basically flies up and out as the train goes forward. It's a nice little moment. And then we get the action movie ending where the train derails and crashes under Wayne Tower. The microwave emitter explodes and it's over. And Ross is dead. So now we get a nice multi-part epilogue. Earl walks into a conference meeting that he did not call, and Fox is there and tells him that he's fired and he got another job and he got Earl's job. And then on speakerphone, Bruce is calling from a limousine and we realize that he still owns the company because when he found out it was going to be sold, that he arranged that he bought most of the shares of Wayne Enterprises. So he has a controlling interest in the company. It's a fun little moment, where he kind of gets over on Earl. And then we get Bruce at Wayne Manor. It's all, they're walking through the wreckage, Rachel, Bruce, and Alfred. And this is the first time that Rachel and Bruce have faced each other now that she has this knowledge that he's Batman. What I was reminded of here is what they did in the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies, where at the end of the first movie, Mary Jane realizes she's in love with Peter, and Peter's like, I can't, it's too dangerous. So they have to put these kind of movies, they have to put impediments between the lovers, right? Because that's what drama is. You can't have them together and happy. There's no story. At the last, he does win Rachel's respect. She apologizes for some of the things she said to him years ago. But she's like, the man I love is in there, but it's before I knew about the mask you wear. And so to her, he is Batman and the mask is Bruce Wayne. And so we get this tagline that maybe one day when Gotham doesn't need Bruce Wayne, that man will come back. So at this point, when we're with both of them, we're like, you don't need her, dude. To hell with her. But whatever. It'll be a major plot line in Dark Knight. So it sets up that relationship. So they have a kiss, but there's no real chemistry between them romantically. It hasn't been in this entire film because they haven't really done, they haven't known each other as adults. So it's all kind of artificial. But anyway, so, they're wandering around. Bruce finds his father's stethoscope, which has survived the fire, even though it's kind of beat up. And we get that nice flashback scene again of him with his dad, reconnecting us to the main theme, right? That Wayne Manor and his father are sort of the foundation on which he stands. Rather than burning it down brick for brick, he's going to rebuild it brick for brick. Then Alfred's like, just the way it was, sir? And they talk about, doing some, obviously, reinforcing of the wing that's connecting the house to make it more, conducive for him to be Batman. So the last shot of the film is on top of the Gotham police station. Gordon has built a bat signal, and so Batman sort of shows up unannounced, and he knocks on it. And they have this wonderful conversation. Gordon's sort of worried about escalation, which is a tease for the theme of The Dark Knight. Then he shows him this, he says, this armed robber leaves a calling card. And it's a great moment because he gives him the card, face down, and then Batman flips it up. And of course, it's the Joker. So it's a wonderful tease to what's to come. The soundtrack swells and is a really beautiful last moment. And Gordon's like, I never said thank you. And Batman says, you'll never have to. And he doesn't disappear on him this time. He allows Gordon to watch him leap from the building. And we are out. So I had a lot to say about this movie. It's probably my favorite comic book movie ever done, and that's having seen the Batman trilogies and all of the X-Men movies and the Marvel movies. My nostalgia for Superman 1 and 2, because they somehow are able to make it a crackerjack story with believable characters that all make sense, terrific female lead character that's not there just for Bruce's enjoyment, There's grandeur in so many of the scenes because of the music and because of the way Nolan shoots some of the things. The action sequences are generally gripping. The realism that they bring to all of, Batman's equipment, the care that's taken in constructing this character, and the sheer amount of information that is packed into every scene in this film is astonishing. I mean, I think that if you wanted to, you could make three movies just from this movie. You could make the Ra's al Ghul section, an entire movie. You can make the Falcone section an entire movie, and you can make the end Ra's al Ghul section an entire movie easily. And to me, I feel like there's three movies in this movie. The first time I saw it, I actually didn't like it very much because the speed of the cuts, the amount of information that was being packed into like every scene bewildered me. Like by the end of the movie, I had been given so much information and so much had been shoehorned into every bloody scene that it was like too much for my brain to actually take in. And only upon further viewings was the movie able to kind of coalesce in my head. And now I really, really admire it. I really think it's a terrific film. And, you know, Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard's score elevates the film. Without this score doing what it does, I don't think this film, to me, achieves the pop grandeur that it does. That elevates past the corniness, past the okay action sequences at times, past the on-the-nose dialogue, the flatly stated themes. But because of the music, besides other things that the way he shot things. But the music is so important to this film. I love it. It's one of my favorite movies, probably, you know, sort of pop action movies. Definitely one of my favorite. And that's all I'm going to say about Batman Begins. So this is part one of a three-part series on Nolan's Batman trilogy, and I will be tackling The Dark Knight next, and then The Dark Knight Rises after that. So I hope you enjoyed it. Look forward to the next one. Thanks for listening.